On then, and ask you to begin, Dr. Martin, by describing Gilead as you found it when you joined in 1990.
Yeah. Well, Gilead in 1990 is about 30 scientists. It's a three-year-old company. And the scientists at Gilead were very good. But the technology that the company was founded on had come into question. The scientists doing the research had realized that that what we're working on, antisense,
right, is
very high risk and not likely to pan out into products in the near or even the longer term.
So was part of bringing you in from Bristol-Myers Squibb part of a change in science and technology direction for the company?
Yeah, it was to move into antivirals.
What was that a... I don't know that much about antisense, but was that a natural tack to take away from antisense to antivirals?
Well,
or
the chemist antisense is oligonucleotides, a chain of nucleotides linked together by chemical bonds.
Right.
And so the building blocks, the single nucleotides, have antiviral potential.
Okay.
So the chemists here had some knowledge of nucleotide chemistry. That being said, chemists can work in a variety of chemistry areas too. So there was something of a link, but the key really is that in 1991 we acquired nucleotide technology from some inventors in Europe.
Now was that
we started a collaboration with two groups in Europe?
Okay. Were these people that you had worked with before, or compounds?
Yeah, in fact, I'd worked with them at Bristol-Myers, so it was a renewal of the Bristol-Myers collaboration at Gilead.
Okay, and was that something that Bristol-Myers was sort of de-emphasizing? Was it?
They did. They de-emphasized that in 1991, so we picked it up.
Gotcha. Well, it's my understanding that soon after you joined Gilead, in about 1991, Gordon Moore joined a business advisory board that the firm had. Do you know how the connection between Gordon Moore and Gilead came about?
You know, I probably do, but I can't remember. And I don't know how often we used that advisory board either. More than 15 years ago, and I know that some of the members came to some of our meetings. Some of the members I've never even met.
Right.
I just really don't know. They were more ad hoc advisors on an as-needed basis.
Okay.
But I really don't know.
Remember. At that time, did you have more to do with a science advisory grouping?
Well, at that time, all we had was really science.
Right. Did you have an outside science advisory board?
We had that too. That was more active, that's for sure. That was the nature of our business. We were basically an R&D organization at the time.
Right. Well, could you talk about then when you first did encounter Gordon Moore?
You know, I just don't remember. I feel like I've known him forever. I really don't know. He joined the board, I believe, January of 96.
Right.
And, I became CEO spring of 96, so his board team, and I joined the board in 95, so he and I kind of overlapped completely all these years.
Right.
He comes to board meetings and committee meetings without fail. He's a very diligent, conscientious member of the board.
Well, maybe we could go back to that early period of your board experience together, just when, you know, at this time when you really took responsibility for leading the firm. Could you describe the composition of the board at that time that you and he first joined up?
Yeah. Well, at the time he joined, George Schultz and Jim Denny also joined, I believe, at that same board meeting.
Right.
And George is now emeritus of the board. He went emeritus about a year ago, still comes to all the board meetings. And Jim has become chairman. In 96, also Don Rumsfeld became chairman of the board at that time and served as chairman until he became Secretary of Defense.
Right.
Yeah. And other people, we had some VCs on the board, but I can't remember when they individually rotated off. Is around that time frame.
Okay. And so it's an interesting, I guess Don Rumsfeld had both sort of like that political, geopolitical perspective and also pharmaceutical industry perspectives.
Well, yeah, Don had a lot of business experience. So I think, you know, geopolitical, the time Don was on the board, Don left the board before we launched our first AIDS drug. And
right.
So we're now much more into the political realm with major products on the market.
Right.
That's been since 2000, end of 2001.
Oh, so that was kind of before, or I guess that was after, those issues really
came up. That was after Don left, yeah.
Yeah. Well, when, it's an interesting mix of sort of, so was Gordon Moore the real chemist and, oh, I guess Paul Berg was on the board too
Paul
at
Berg
that time.
Came to the board subsequent to 96, so subsequent to Gordon.
Okay.
And again, we could look up and find the year Paul joined, but I don't remember exactly what it is. It's probably, I'm guessing that Paul joined spring of 99, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay.
But about 3 years after Gordon.
Were they the two real technologists in addition to yourself or scientists on the board?
Yeah, but you know, Gordon's experience is so broad, I tend to not think of him as a technologist. Obviously he built up Intel, so he has broad experience on people issues, business issues, accounting issues, finance issues, in addition to some very good scientific judgment. He'll, you know, in any scientific presentation, he can see immediately what the key issues are and what, you know, come to conclusions about what he's heard.
Do you think he brings that same sort of analytical ability to bear on some of those other sort of business management issues?
Oh, yeah, he chairs our compensation committee, for instance.
Has he done that for a while, or is that...
You know, I don't know when he started doing that, but it's been for a number of years now.
Right. Could you talk about, I know that was an area, compensation, in which he was very, very heavily involved at Intel. Could you talk a little bit about what he's done in that area with you at Gilead?
Well, he's just, I would say that, you know, how do I describe this? There are a lot of guidelines of how we, you know, we compensate people and how we compensate over time and what's the right mix of compensation, especially with regards to stock options, and how do you quantify the value of the stock options. And his experience at Intel and his knowledge of that has proven extremely valuable at Gilead.
Mm-hmm. Because I think they were quite an innovator in some of those very practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the thing, you know, there's been a lot of issues and concerns in the media about have we gone overboard in terms of compensation on stock options. And Gordon's made sure that we understand the value of stock options and have conservative practices.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and of course it helps that Gilead's a company that's over the last 10 years is growing substantially, so that the you can be conservative on stock option grants and employees still perceive and, you know, receive a substantial value.
Right.
But it's based on the performance of the company, not just, you know, money that's not based on the performance of the company.
I see. Yeah. Success of the company, you can take a very conservative approach, but it still works out as a great incentive. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to the mid-90s, let's say, when Gordon first came on the board, could you describe just your impressions of his standing in Bay Area business and financial and investment communities?
Well, I mean, yeah, I, people, I'm sure he's highly regarded.
Yeah. Did you, was his a name that was instantly recognizable to you at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to live in Silicon Valley, everyone knows of Gordon Moore.
Well, with that sort of reputation, how would you say that Gordon has approached his role as a board member?
Well, he's very careful and deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, it's not that he doesn't speak up; he speaks up a lot, but his comments are always very well considered and important to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think he's cautious about what he says, in part because of the sort of reputational weight behind what he might say?
Yeah, I never thought of that. I just think, I'm sure he, the way he talks now is the way he's talked all his life. So
yeah.
I think it's, his personality is just, he's very thoughtful, I think is the way to put it.
Mm-hmm. If you had to name a few, what would you point to as his major contributions as a board member?
No, I don't know how to quantify that.
Mm-hmm.
His thoughtful advice on at every meeting is a major contribution. Certainly, his leadership of the Compensation Committee has been critical. Absolutely critical for the success of that group and Gilead's success. And one other thing that is hard to quantify is how the values of the board, the individual members of the board, and the board collectively influence the values of the company overall. So I would say that Gilead is a conservative company that really focuses on trying to do the right thing. And that's emanates from the board and certainly from Gordon Moore.
Mm-hmm. And is expressed in the policies that they come up with?
Yeah, on our values and all that.
I know at Intel, they, Gordon Moore and others in the sort of top leadership positions eventually came to be quite explicit about Intel culture and driving that down through the organization, particularly important for such a sensitive sort of manufacturing concern, like they were involved with there. But did have you needed to or done that at all at Gilead?
We've done it a total of 3 times at Gilead.
Hmm.
I think the third time probably we have it, and it turns out really defining the values and the mission and all that. The third one, which is probably the one we did after Gordon joined board.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly, when you talk about what Intel is all about, we're in the pharmaceutical industry and values is critical because people, trust in our products is essential.
Right.
People are taking medications to improve their life. They need to be confident that what they're taking not only is, pure and appropriately manufactured, but also that the data, the clinical data, the human clinical data that backs it up is a fair representation of what the molecule or the drug does in people.
Mm-hmm. So those culture issues become paramount again.
Yeah. We use it for recruiting people. All new employees are trained in the values. We have a laminated description of the values that we give to everyone.
Hmm.
It's integral in our business.
It's been in the past, since you both have been working together on the board, it's been in a period of just extraordinary growth for the firm. Can you point to some ways, in addition to the very important compensation issues, that he's helped you with managing that growth?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's also served on the audit committee, which is historically has. He doesn't anymore,
mm-hmm.
which is a very challenging area to make sure that, to back up, when a company grows, grows rapidly like we have,
yeah,
it's very difficult for the infrastructure to keep up with the growth.
Right.
So the audit committee has been instrumental in helping us to, and having experienced people like Gordon on it, in helping us to manage that growth, make sure we have the appropriate controls in place to be successful.
Right. Because he has had twice over experience, mm-hmm, with that same sort of growth.
Yeah. Of course, if we grow and we've added members to the board, and I think Gordon, the opportunity to work with Gordon on the board has been a positive thing in terms of attracting new members to the board.
Oh. Yeah. I can see what.
As you can see, it's obvious. Yeah.
Sure, but I didn't think of it until you said it. We talked a little, we were just talking about some of the manufacturing issues. Has he had a role in that? Because certainly he's been very involved in a highly delicate manufacturing,
yeah,
sort of business.
Well, we have had manufacturing presentations with the board.
Yes.
But it's probably more, again, in the culture of the company. We're very conservative on manufacturing. That means we manufacture to a high quality, make sure we maintain adequate inventories, make sure we have adequate backup suppliers of raw materials. And I'm sure that in conversations, Gordon's probably emphasized that, but it's something that, is more, again, it's ingrained in the culture of the company.
Right.
So, that's why, that's a perfect example of why it's hard to quantify.
Yes.
Something that he has knowledge about, understands, and appreciates our conservative approach.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturing, I should make the point, compared to the semiconductor industry or consumer product industry, the manufacturing industry for pharmaceuticals is highly regulated by the FDA. We have frequent inspections by FDA. They require manufacturers to work to a very high quality standard and quality assurance standard. And the standards have been increasing over time.
Mm.
So in a way, Gilead is in an advantageous position because we don't have a historical legacy of manufacturing facilities that might not meet the modern standards of manufacturing.
Right. Because you can just build them to be from the get go adapted to the.
So we're starting. We start out right away. Now that being said, most of our manufacturing is done by third party manufacturers. But for instance, our active drugs are typically manufactured by fine chemical manufacturers, and not other companies in the pharmaceutical industry.
Hmm.
Because the fine chemical manufacturers are the ones that. That's their business, is to make molecules. Whereas the pharmaceutical industry, their business is to make drugs, and they have their manufacturing facilities are historically older in some cases.
Huh. So is that?
So we just bought, for instance, a manufacturing facility for drugs up in Edmonton, Alberta, last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought one of our contract manufacturers. 60% of their business was Gilead, and their facility was constructed in 1996, so it's only 10 years old.
Right.
So that's an example. That facility was built based on the demand of Gilead products.
Okay. Is that something that is distinguishing about Gilead? Is that sort of an innovative practice you're doing in manufacturing in that respect?
Well, maybe where Gilead's probably more innovative or different from other companies is the amount of work that we do outside of the company. So we work with a variety of other companies around the world, but we make sure we have the expertise internally to manage those relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the quality mechanisms internally and the manufacturing and scientific expertise to manage these processes. But for instance, we manufacture our products in Korea, United States, Canada, France, Germany, Bahamas, South Africa, through other companies.
And so you have whole groups that work in those manufacturing partnerships to make mm-hmm. sure that they... Right.
And that's pretty much true for every other area of the company. We work with an extensive network of other organizations.
For the other functions of distribution and...
Yeah, and, you know, for instance, clinical research, we contract out a lot of the aspects of the clinical trial management.
And so you've developed managing those relationships with these outside specialists?
Yeah, I think the way you look at it is that you might have a department of a large number of people within a company.
Mm-hmm.
But in our case, the management's there, but a lot of the other people work somewhere else.
I understand.
Yep.
Well, another area that in preparing for this interview that I was really kind of struck by that I thought was very interesting and innovative was the no profit and small profit pledges with
the tiered pricing.
Yeah, the tiered pricing for the antiretroviral drugs. I guess that really came to the fore in the 2002-2004 but I'm sure it continues to be a big deal today. Could you talk about how that approach emerged in the company, how you guys came up with that?
When we announced our no profit price for the developing world, a reporter called me and asked me exactly that question. How'd you come up with that?
Yeah.
And even though no one else was doing it, to us, it was just obvious all along. I mean, we never actually considered an alternative.
That's interesting.
And probably the way to look at it is you think of the pharmaceutical industry as coming up with drugs to address unmet medical needs.
Right.
Or a drug to treat a disease that's not being treated. Mm-hmm. Or a drug that can treat a disease better than the drugs are already there. Everyone thinks that's the unmet medical need. But the bigger unmet medical need is just access to medicine that we already have.
Mm.
And we're not going to make any real money selling drugs into really resource-poor countries. And price is a barrier to access. And so that's our part to remove the barriers to charge a no-profit price. And the key point is to, we're a company that works to make money and provide shareholders with return on their investment. So we don't want to lose money in those markets, but we also want to do our part that we can to make sure that there is access to our medications.
I was wondering if there, it was an assumption that, an operating assumption as you worked on these drugs that...
I don't know if we thought about it all along the way. I think one of the ways to look at it is before you make a product available broadly and know those types of markets, you want to have a lot of safety data on it already. Not just the 1,000 patients you study to get it approved by the U.S. FDA, but the couple hundred thousand that you get when it's commercially available and used in the real world and a lot of people.
Right.
And you find out a lot about drugs. You only have to read the newspapers to know how much you find out about drugs once they're commercially available.
Right.
And so sometimes things pop up. And if you had your product available or in a couple hundred thousand people in those other settings where you can't monitor as carefully, then that would be of concern. So we had the product. And so I think it's just an evolution as things move along. The decision on how to do that was fairly straightforward. The actual implementation, the setting of prices, the negotiation of the tiers with other countries,
mm-hmm.
that's very difficult, very complicated, takes a lot of work. The regulatory approvals, just because we have a no-profit product doesn't mean the country will get regulatory approvals in those countries. And that can be very difficult.
Right.
But the actual concept of a no-profit price for those markets was pretty straightforward.
I was just wondering, was there any sort of precedent for that in the pharmaceutical industry or in a completely different type of industry?
Oh, in all other industries, people make a profit.
Yeah.
Those markets, so there's no real precedent. And more recently, we provided a license for those markets to 11 Indian generic companies.
Mm-hmm.
There's no precedent for that either. Again, we don't have a history. Just like Coca-Cola, for instance, has infrastructure in Africa and sells Coke and makes a profit. The pharmaceutical industry does, too. So all the big pharmaceutical companies have these infrastructures. But we didn't have the burden of business units in those parts of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
So could you characterize Gordon Moore's involvement in just this area? How would you describe his involvement with?
Well, he's been a part of the, that, you know, I described a continuous process.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. So you're putting together a biography, basically, right?
That's right.
But you've done writing in the past for books or for like media or
articles. Yeah, of all different kinds. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you're always. I know when you write something, you want to know what the aha moment is to be able to characterize that. But
yeah.
So often it's just a process, you know, of a continuous evolution of thought.
Right.
Or drug development, you know, when did you know this drug would be as successful as it is? Well, there's no one moment.
Mm-hmm.
Or when did you know the FDA would approve the drug? Well, there's no one moment. It's not when the FDA actually approves it, because there's a process of working with the FDA to get to the approval. And so, Gordon, in all these things that we do, and we talk about them pretty intensely at the board, is an active participant in the evolution of that thought.
Right.
To get to the point where we have an implementation or something like that.
Right.
Launch of a product.
Well, I guess I would say, I understand what you're saying, and maybe I was pushing for the aha moment. I guess I was also looking to hear if, for example, he was skeptical, or if he was on the board a real driver, you know, on this issue, sort of that sort of.
I think what the role of the board is often to be somewhat skeptical about things and ask lots of questions and challenge assumptions. Gordon, you know, he's very good at that.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he's actually skeptical. You know, he's just looking through the various angles of what we're trying to do. And in the end, of course, he's highly supportive. And I'm sure he gets a lot of personal satisfaction about his involvement in helping us create what we've created at Gilead.
Is it... let's see. How would you characterize? Was it was this tiered pricing a major discussion point for the board? Has it been?
Actually, maybe twice a year for the last 5 years.
Just
to throw out a number, you know.
Right.
So we have four major board meetings a year. Probably at every other one, we discuss some aspect of this type of issue.
Okay.
Because it moves around the world. Also, you know, one of the things board wants to guard ferociously is our very positive brand. So this type of issue is highly visible to the public and is important to our brand.
Right. Let's see. I'm trying to think of how the practice or the approach of the tiered pricing has moved out beyond Gilead, and has it been adopted widely? Has it become also a sort of a model of how to do things that
no, governments I don't think it really has. No, I'd say it hasn't been adopted widely. Other companies to varying degrees have. So, you know, we have two prices. We have lower in the middle income. We have lower middle income and upper middle income. And we have our full price markets of North America and Europe.
Right.
But the, you know, the, you, over time you get erosion and the uniformity of pricing anyway, because of different laws in different countries.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, for companies that have been around longer with a mix of products, it's much more difficult to manage. Also, as I mentioned, companies have business units in some of these areas where we don't have business units. So the business unit, in terms of their overall profit and loss, they take a different view than what a corporate headquarters might take for a worldwide profit and loss.
So it's really...
Are examples of companies having no profit prices.
But right.
The uniformity through the tiers, I don't think there are examples yet.
And it's in part because you have essentially... with those outside partnerships to fulfill these different functions, that in a way that structure allows you to pursue this tiered pricing approach because you don't have the internal resistances and...
Yeah, there's some of that.
Yeah.
There's also, one thing I can say is, you know, our pricing is very reasonable. We haven't pushed the envelope on pricing. And so when we go to countries and talk about our tiered pricing approach, for the most part, they can be pretty happy because the price we're offering is a price that's quite reasonable.
So they go into it, believe you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing you might want, you can check the last few weeks in the media, there's been the issue of Abbott in Thailand, where Abbott price in Thailand for an AIDS drug was $2,500 per patient year. That's been resolved. They've dropped it to $1,000 per patient year. But our price in Thailand's a dollar a day, so $350 per patient year.
Right.
Or an AIDS product, just, you know, their product is an AIDS product.
Right.
So we're not pushing the envelope at all in Thailand, for instance.
Right.
But there is, you know, Thailand has over 500,000 people who are HIV positive, and it is a medical emergency for their country, and we think our price is the appropriate tiered price in the economic analysis we've done to come up with this pricing scheme.
Do you, it sounds like it involves very complicated financial modeling and economic modeling across all of these areas.
I don't know if it's complicated, but process to get there, you know, it takes a lot of time.
Right. That way. Right. Does do you get scale effects from one area to the other? That is to say, you know, if you take a no profit approach in one area, that might mean that you get a certain increase of scale of the manufacturing that
I guess it's true that you could probably, if you scale the manufacturing, have a lower cost of goods.
Yeah.
But remember, we've given these licenses to the Indian generics. So what we want to do, the issue of scale is the scalability of providing treatment to the tens of millions of people that need it and aren't getting it.
Right.
So what we wanted to do was create an environment of competition in those markets where there would be multiple companies competing for those patients. We think that would be the way to get more people to have access to medication. It's an experiment, we'll see.
So I'm sorry to say that I didn't catch that licensing in my research for this talk, for talking with you today. Is that a very a low cost or no cost license that you've given?
5% royalty.
Oh, okay. So quite moderate.
I think it's kind of what a WTO standard would be.
Okay. And that's for your current generation.
Truck, yeah, the big stage truck.
Wow.
So that we transferred technology to 11 companies in India to manufacture generic product, but it's exclusively for our no-profit markets. I think one of the things, you know, we're not, we don't want to give everything away, and part of the deal is to protect intellectual property in our other markets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important to us, because if companies can't be rewarded for their innovation when it costs so much to develop a drug, the drug simply won't be developed.
Sure. And so this is a kind of, you're taking a sort of a managed approach across the board to that issue. I mean, I believe, you know, there has been just some instances of these generics houses saying, well, we're just going to make drug X, Y, or Z because we need it, and the government sort of gives them the nod to do that.
Yeah, to some degree, what you're saying is correct. There's always sort of more levels. That's a good summary. Let's put it that way.
Right, and this is a way of facing that reality in a more controlled and structured way. It's very interesting.
But like I said, David, it's an experiment. We'll see how it turns out.
Well, I'll be interested. I think it's a very interesting experiment.
Yep.
I was wondering, just on a personal level, of you leading the firm, you know, through this amazing period of growth to this place on sort of the world stage with your products. If you got any personal advice from Gordon Moore, who underwent a similar experience himself with Intel and the microprocessor kind of catapulting the firm and him into this global arena. Have you two had occasions to compare notes on that, or?
You know, he often mentions things about Intel and, you know, how they did stuff.
Right.
And one of the easy examples we already brought up is stock options, because his guidance there on how we should handle stock options has been extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that he's really set the stage for us to understand how to do that. We give stock options broadly to employees, and his guidance has been critical. There's absolutely no doubt. But there's been a lot of other sort of instances of things, but, you know, I don't keep notes. I don't recall any of that stuff.
Okay. It seems that my impression is that you have had a very stable executive team.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
And that was also the case at Intel for the most part, in the uppermost sort of echelon of the executive team.
You brought up a good point. That's something that he's talked about and has encouraged, you know, make sure we retain our key people.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, because that was one similarity that really popped out at me, because in both, you know, semiconductors and in biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, you know, there's a lot of inter-firm mobility and that sort of stuff, so.
Yeah, you know, we have three EVPs, and two of them joined Gilead before I did, so they were less than the 30th employee.
Right.
And, you know, that's 1% of the people we have now, so that's pretty phenomenal when you think about it.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, certainly when he was CEO in Intel, he really used both stock options and, you know, executive compensation. I think there's a...
it goes well beyond compensation. It goes to making sure that talented people work in the company, have an opportunity to do things that they find fulfilling, and will stay with the company.
Right.
So it really involves a lot of what people, you know, how you develop people and what they have the opportunity to work on day to day, and what monetary part.
Sure.
Really important. So Gordon, of course, like other board members, but Gordon has articulated this, it's important that the key individuals have an opportunity to come in and meet with the board and present to the board to receive that additional recognition.
Right. I think I have basically two other issues that I'd like to briefly cover with you. One is your common background of you and Gordon Moore both being chemists. You an organic chemist, he a physical chemist. Have you seen anything of a Gordon bring a chemist's perspective to bear with his involvement?
It's a stretch to call Gordon or me a chemist anymore. No, we're so far beyond that. But what we really are scientists. And the scientific judgment to be able to look at data and assess it and say, does that make sense? Is there another interpretation? Are we looking at a difference that's significant? In other words, you can say A is better than B, but it might be so what? You can say it's better, but in reality, it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
So the scientific judgment on scientific experiments and scientific discussion, there's no doubt that Gordon's maintained that all these years.
Right.
He does very well with scientists.
Right. And then the last issue would be to ask you to just describe Gordon on a personal level, his personality, character, perspective, if you had what you regard as a revealing story.
I don't have a revealing story, but it's he's exactly what he seems to be. You know, he's not any different than what he seems to be day in and day out. So he's very, stabilizing and thoughtful. Has a good sense of humor, works well with people.
Well, let's see. Those were, I guess those were all of the major issues that I wanted to discuss with you.
I think you covered the list.
Is there anything that I've not asked you about that I should have if I were?
No, you've been thorough and you've got me to remember some things or perspectives that I hadn't thought of.
Well, good. Then I think I've done my job then.
Okay.
Let me just switch off the recorder and then I'll just, if you could bear with me, I just wanted to talk to you about